Number 14A.
We go on in that rhythm of that last section from principle, from the point of view of love, where we could see the consummation really of the whole omni-action of principle, first from the point of view of the word, really the resurrection, the demonstration of principle of what Jesus was here for. That was his mission, to be resurrected and brought back to the Father. As the Christ, he fulfilled and consummated really that for which he also was come. You remember when in the first chapter of the Gospel, Jesus was depicted as the identity of the Christ idea, that the second point of Christ was that he came, that he is coming to say, to take away the sin of the world. And now here at the Christ, he consummates that, because he shows he breathed into them the Holy Ghost to take away all sin. Take away all sin. First it was that the sin of the world, and now it is to take away all sin. So we get a very definite sense of the Christ fulfilling its saving mission. Then the situation changes completely, and we come to that situation where the disciples were fishing at night. It was night, they have lost the vision, and so Jesus had to resurrect their vision. And he came and said, "Don't you get any fishes?" And he said, "No, we don't get them." He said, "Well, you fish on the wrong side. You have to fish on the right side. If you fish on the wrong side, you won't get anywhere. The right side is always in the candlestick, life, truth, and love. See, so put your net to the right side, not only to mind, spirit, soul, which is also necessary, but that alone doesn't give a demonstration. It's only the foundation, mind, spirit, soul, for principle to be omni-active and bring forth, really, the abundance of life." So he could see that if we have founded ourselves rightly on mind, spirit, soul, that then principle begins to act by itself. We have that seen in the first part already. The moment Christ was identified rightly as the calculus, then that calculus, from the point of view of love, began to operate as principle, life, truth, and love. Here you have the consummation in a universal sense, that he said, "You see, if you throw out your net, your system, a net is a system." What we are really doing since two days or so, we had first a net with great meshes. You say meshes, huh? So that we only had four meshes in it. Then we made smaller meshes, put truth and love in it. So we had already eight meshes. Gets finer and finer. So now we have put in the subtones and get already finer and finer meshes. So that the complexity of science, the complexity of being, is understood step by step in a better way. So here too we see that if we get the finer mesh of life, truth, and love, instead of just mind, spirit, soul, we are able to demonstrate in a better way. So they did catch fishes in abundance. So Christianity shows the demonstration of abundance, the superabundance of demonstration he was showing there. And only then, and they did that, they began to recognize that the man on the shore was Jesus. Only through the demonstration they began to recognize really what Jesus was. In the textbook, Mrs. Eddy says that the students only began to see the Christ through the demonstrations of the Christ, and not the other way around. We try now in this gospel to understand the Christ through the system of science, not through the demonstrations, but the demonstration come as a fallout, so to say. Huh? To say a fallout as a side effect of the understanding. Meaning understanding is leading to demonstration. As most people have want first to see the demonstration, and then perhaps they think it's worthwhile investigating and get an understanding. But that's very seldom that they get the understanding that way. That's why Jesus never chose as his disciple somebody who needed help. He didn't take those who he healed as his disciples, not one of them. He knew what was needed was a spiritual sense, a spiritual leaning towards science. That is the better ground than those who are only convinced by demonstrations, by healings, by having nice experiences and so on. Therefore, one can see that if really those who have got the demonstration in Christian Science since 120 years and so on, if those had really asked what is the understanding that has brought forth the demonstration and would have investigated the understanding, then Christian Science would have been spread all over the world, because we had millions and millions who had wonderful healings, but they didn't do a trick. What does the trick is our spiritual consciousness, And so here too we begin to see that only when we have that right sense of life, truth and love as a moving principle in being, that we can really, that we have then an understanding that brings forth demonstration. And the superabundance of demonstration. They couldn't use everything that they were catching. So it's always more there than what we need. So abundance is not enough. The whole world and nature is built the way that it is, has superabundance. You know, a fir tree has thousands of seeds that fall down to the ground. And out of those thousands and thousands, only one or the other has a chance to grow. So nature works with superabundance, and the spiritual realm also works with superabundance. It really does that what here is shown, that first Jesus breathed into the disciples the Holy Ghost, which would take away all sins, and right afterwards they couldn't handle it. They couldn't even fish properly. So he had to rectify that again and say, now look here, I show you that you must go over what is called in the Bible the 3.5, over from the objective of mind, spirit, soul, touching a little bit of principle, to that point where you go out from principle and see from principle operating, then it operates as life, truth and love. And finally, the last incident, which is a very interesting incident again, I think I say it every time, huh? It's very interesting, incident where Jesus was talking to Peter and was saying, "Dost thou love me?" And Peter naturally said, "Oh yes, I love you, you know it." And Jesus asked again, "Do you love me?" Peter said, "Oh yes, you know, Master, that I love you." And the third time he asked, "Do you love me?" And Peter got a bit impatient. That's the nature of Peter. He was a wonderful character. He got a little bit impatient and said, "Golly, finally give peace. I told you already 2 times I love you. Isn't that enough now?" So the English text doesn't give us the clue to it, the key to it. The Greek has for love 4 terms. But John only uses 2 terms. He never uses the other 2 terms in the Greek. And those 2 terms in the Greek have 2 different connotations, as you know. The one is agape, which is the principle called love. The other is philia, which is the nice feeling of loving, of lovey-dovey loving. Huh? Yeah. So Jesus always used the term agape. Do you agape me? Is your love capitalized? And Peter answered always with filio, with a not capitalized, with a lowercase l, which shows that And Peter, at that point, hasn't quite got the idea that he felt, well, what Jesus was teaching and living is really something very lovely. And we had such lovely occasions with him. And it was such a lovely time with him. And it was just lovely, you know. You know, lovely, lovely is a very nice term that you hear so often, but it's not love, capital L. Capital L has nothing to do with a cozy situation. Sometimes it has to do with a very tough situation. Meaning, again, love is never without its manifestation. That's love. Where we have never a feeling within us that perfection is not expressed. If you have that feeling that perfection is always at the point of being manifested and expressed, then we have love with a capital L. And that's something different. So finally Jesus gave in and asked him, do you love me as filio? Do you filio me? And Peter said, yes, I love you, I filio you. So they were on a common ground of human loving. And Jesus must have felt, well, that's good enough for the moment, dear Peter, but that's not enough. You will have to go through trouble until you find out what I was teaching you, until you find out that I wasn't teaching you lovey-dovey, that I was teaching you that there is a plan of love and that love has such an attraction that the Christ idea is going to fulfill that plan of love. And on that way, many things happen which are unpleasant, but the plan is being worked out. Therefore, he could make the difference between John and Peter. When at the end Jesus said to John, just follow me, all right, I follow you. And John said, but what about Peter? He's left behind. So Jesus said to him, what does that matter to you? That's not your business. That's not your business what another individual does, how the other individual has his own Christ and works out his own salvation in his own way, but not the way John is working it out. And so the word got around that really Peter had to learn his lesson through suffering, whereas John learned the lesson through science. And that's the way it ends. All right, there is still another little verse there that says, well, that principle is so omniactive in the whole world that we can't tell you everything about it. Those books would fill the whole world if we would write down all the things that happen. The infinite divine calculus, or the divine infinite calculus, is infinite, and therefore we only need to know really the calculus itself, the structure of the calculus itself. Then, if we have that, then it opens up infinitude. It's infinite then. No, there is no more any boundary to it. And that is what I want to show you in one example during this and the next hour, how really that divine infinite calculus can be seen as infinite, so that we don't have to write down every possible calculation. In arithmetic, we have infinite calculation. Our textbook don't give us all the infinite calculations. They only give us the system of it and a few examples just to make that system explicable to us, more tangible to us. But the textbook on arithmetic doesn't give us the infinite calculations. Gives us only the principle for it. Now, we have got that principle now pretty well as far as we have gone. Actually, we have left out a lot. We have out all those empty boxes in our diagram. They would give us now a finer mesh, still a finer mesh, so that we would again come back to that point where we said, well, we have found here a wonderful statement as we were going through all these epitomes, but actually we don't know quite what they mean. So we would have to ask the explanation again of that statement. And in this way, the meshes become finer and finer, therefore our consciousness becomes also finer and finer, I would say more complex, because we're building constantly new categories, so that finally we have a very dainty presentation of the system, like a filigram work, you see, very dainty, there is all the details are filled in. And that is what I want to do from now on. We go right back again to the beginning and say, all right, what we have seen through these epitomes, that has already enlarged our consciousness. We already have seen something more concrete, something more definite about it, but still there were questions open and where we could see, well, how can we really fill in those questions and give an answer? Now, so I go back to part one again. Part one is always a bit, it's built up a bit differently than part two, three, and four, because it's the introduction into the calculus, and so gives first the word standpoint and shows through the word order really how the Christ idea can be born in us. And so we go back to those underlined epitomes in the first part. And I want to spend quite a bit time just on mind, spirit, and soul, because it's a simple proposition, but it takes a lot of time. I can't do that with every box that is empty, because that would take us weeks and weeks. So I only want to show through one example, really, how the world could be filled with books and books and books if we would tell everything we can tell, still remaining within the system, not going out of the system. And I will try it, and I don't know how successful I will be, but we try and try and try again. We come to the first part, the word from the point of view of truth, and we have seen there that truth, the underlined epitome, truth reveals the Son of God. What is the Son of God? If we leave it at that point, we would have a mystical sense of the Son of God. We couldn't quite imagine that God, whom we don't know and don't see, but he can have a son, and therefore we couldn't know what that son is either. See, that's naturally why the Jewish religion could not accept really Christian religion, because they couldn't figure out that thing, that God would have a son. That was so foreign to their conception, because they would have to see an example of it. And so they rejected that. So we too should reject it as such a statement and just say, well, God has sent the son. So what does it mean? What can we do with that from morning to night? What can we do with that in our business, with our family, with our bodily problems? We can't do anything with that by just saying that God has a son. So we jolly well have to see how to translate this mystical language out of itself into a language that we understand a little bit better, so that it makes a bit more sense. And so we tried to do that from the text here, and could see that John was helping us very much, showing what that son may mean to us, namely by defining his identity as the divine infinite calculus at the point of soul. But he also showed how we could give birth to that Son of God, so that we are not just at the position where we say, yes, there is a Son of God. We jolly well have to say to ourselves, what have I to do? That I am the Son of God. That the Son of God is really created and born and identified within me or else it doesn't really do a trick. It must be Emmanuel, it must be God with us, so that we have to give birth to the calculus, to the Christ calculus within us. So if we take the not underlined epitome as creator, as the first one, so we can see, oh, creator, yes, I have learned in Christian Science that that is mind. I haven't learned that from the Bible. The Bible has just said that God created it. So, again, it's mystical. It's not definite. But because Mrs. Eddy has revealed, really, that mind is the creator, that mind is the creative ability within ourselves, we have already a clearer concept of it. So, the biblical text just only says that, really, the Logos was the light, and the light came into the world, and as many as believed, now we have already understanding, as many as understood or believed on this Logos, to him gave him power to become the Son of God. So we have already the first indication, where do we have to start in order to become the Son of God? Apparently we have to start with that light, which is the divine mind. We know that from the textbook, not from the Bible. And the textbook, the Bible goes on, which is not, now we are introduced, what is not the real creator, which creator is not meant. Namely, it's not meant that is born of blood of the woman, nor of the will of the flesh by the man, nor of the will of man, but of God. So we have a terrific introduction already, where we could see that we are not born of human parents, that there is an origin, a creative ability, which is above human parents, which at that time was called God, which at our time through the textbook is called the parent mind, capital M. So I have already quite a foothold in it and say, oh yes, now I can stand on solid ground. I know now that mind is that which created the man of God. And so mind is the creator. Yes, so if we come to that point, which we have talked about already before, we can now see that we can put into this concept a finer mesh, so that it becomes more definite and clearer. How can I put into it a finer mesh? There I have to drop the biblical text and have to go to the Christian Science textbook, because the Bible doesn't tell us any more about a finer mesh, but the textbook does. Because the textbook doesn't say just, you are born of mind. It also shows what mind is. It also defines mind through the ideas of mind. And therefore, the more I know what mind is as a category, or as a subcategory in this case, I know the content of this subcategory of a capitalized term, mind. So that I can see, oh, this is terrific. I can know really what that mind has created, because it has created all that which is the inner content of mind. And if I know the ideas of mind, I can enlarge really that sense that mind has created the Son of God. I can enlarge it by bringing in the ideas of mind. The ideas of mind, which I can see, well, mind is the... I better stop here before I go on.